Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
An Erios production.
Menopause is coming and the men have all left town, but I'm not giving up until I see that baby crown. 39 and single, can someone help me out? He could be bald and bearded, short or tall, funny, smart, love basketball, from gay, straight, black to white, tiny eyes with an underbite, I just need sperm.
Hello. Hi there. Well, I got my genetic test results back from the lab finally, and the results are not very clear, or maybe they are clear, but I don't understand them very well. It's all very confusing, and I went to the genetic counselor this morning, the same place where I got the bad news in December. So needless to say, I have not been feeling so hot today. In fact, here I am in the car driving home from the appointment.
Driving home from the genetic counselor in a really bad mood, feeling really unhappy, which is different than sadness for me. Sad doesn't necessarily mean I can't find joy, but today I'm really just, and yesterday, just feeling unhappy. I don't want to smile. I don't have anything to laugh about. And I'm just realizing how long the road is ahead of me and frustrated by that and tired, and I just don't know what to do. I don't want to do any of it. I just want a baby, my baby. I want this to be done with. I want it to be over. But I know I'll feel better later today, tomorrow, next week, whatever. I know this feeling is temporary, and I'm just feeling down because of the...
In 1 mile, use the right 2 lanes to take exit 3, Springbrook Parkway, New York City, to Taconic Parkway.
Oh, I guess I can laugh. Oh, Lord. I'm fine, I guess. No, I just being at that office, the maternal fetal medicine office, and being reminded of the day of the terrible news and the amnio, and sitting there so helpless with my dad speaking to the genetic counselor. Just such a sad, sad day. I will get better soon or feel better soon.
Exit right to exit 3.
I hear you.
Springbrook Parkway, New York City, to Taconic Parkway.
Thank you.
Then use the left lane to keep left to Springbrook Parkway.
All right, so you get the picture. I'll get into the details of my genetic testing results next week once I've had a moment to sit with them and figure out what they mean. But if you want more info sooner than later, I'm sure I'll put them up on the Patreon. And if you're not a member, you can always sign up at patreon.com/spermcast. And while we're on the subject, I want to thank my latest subscriber, Allison S., who I think I might have missed last week, and Angela C., who raised her tier. Thank you both so much. Now, back to this, and I don't want to be a downer, okay? So here we go. Today we're talking to my midwife, Robin. Why are we talking to her? Because I just got her retirement announcement in the mail, and it says this. It has been my great pleasure attending to my patients for 44 years. You have trusted me with the most personal, intimate, sometimes heartbreaking, and most often joyous moments of your life. It's been wonderful to know you, and I've learned much from you. I hope that I have given as much as I have received. Well, to that, I wrote Robin a text message, a very, very sappy text message, telling her how grateful I was that I had the opportunity to be in her care for 2 months. Robin not only took care of me and held my hand through all of my heartbreak in December, but she's the one who keyed me into the fact that my milk was preterm milk and good for preemies. And without that teeny bit of information, I probably wouldn't have started pumping and donating to begin with. Now, I know I said that these next few episodes were going to be about adoption, but I wanted to talk to Robin on the show while I could. I mean, can you imagine the thousands of births she's attended and the thousands of miracles? Oh my goodness. So without further ado, here is my midwife, Robin Bradley. Hi, Robin.
Hey, Molly.
First, of course, I asked her why she was retiring.
I had always intended, by the time I got to this age, and I'd been thinking about it a lot over the last 2 or 3 years, that it's getting harder and harder to be on call. And when we were on call, we were on call for long periods of time. And when I was younger, it was, I could stay up for 2 or 3 days and then take 24 hours to recover and be back, you know, on square one. But it was getting harder to do that. And so it was always my intent, and what I thought I was going to be able to access was the ability to continue to work and reduce the amount of call I was taking. Mm-hmm. When I approached that last fall, that was not an option. And so it was either continue to take call the way I had been taking call or resign. I think it was a combination of the fact that the midwives were pretty stressed. And I think the thought of having somebody working and not sharing in the call, even though, you know, the lip service I kind of got was that, you know, we'd all like to know that that possibility is there for us eventually.
Right.
They weren't quite ready to make it accessible right now.
Huh. Huh.
So, you know, what I said to everybody was, I don't know if I'm finished. I don't know if I'm done. I love what I do. Okay. I've always loved what I do. I will say the last night that I was on call, I had 3 births. And
oh
yeah,
my goodness.
Like, it was like going out in a trial of fire. But each one of them, I told each one of them, you know, this is my last day of call. And I'm sharing that with you. Let's make it special.
Uh-huh.
And they did, each one of them in their own way. It was such a special, they were such special births.
Oh my goodness.
And all so very different. We were very connected.
Yeah.
In a time. And the stories that we were able to share with each other about, you know, I was able to share my stories about my birth. I don't typically do that. I don't find it helpful for people to hear about my birth and my stories about being a mother and the trials and tribulations for learning how to be a mother. So yeah, it was a lovely 24 hours.
Of course, I needed to know all about her birth too.
I had a baby. And I had the best of plans. I was going to leave the hospital in 12 hours. I was going to go home. I was going to nurse my baby. I was going to go back to work right away. And, you know, I had all these plans. I had a horrible, horrible postpartum hemorrhage.
Oh, no.
My daughter had meconium. I pushed for 3.5 hours. My daughter had meconium aspiration syndrome, which back in the early 70s was quite dangerous.
Yeah.
And I refused a transfusion. I made them.
Why did you refuse a transfusion?
Because I was in the Bronx in the mid 70s when hepatitis was.
Oh my gosh.
And as a nurse, I was like, if you think I'm taking blood from here, you got to be crazy.
Oh my gosh.
So I went home with a hematic. Well, you know what it.
I know.
So you know what that's like. That's why I said, I know what it feels like.
Yes.
So I went home like that. With the baby who was biting me. I didn't know about tongue tie at the time.
Oh my gosh. So you're talking about a lot of things that I never got to talk about yet on the podcast because I was, you know, no. I talked about all of my stuff. I'm talking about before when I was pregnant, I was going through all the things that I might experience. And there's just so much that I never even got a chance to get into. No. Tongue tie and meconium. I mean, I did one episode where we talked about meconium, but
yeah,
it's a lot of stuff.
It was a lot of stuff. I had to leave the hospital, had to leave my daughter at the hospital. So I, in retrospect, my sense is the universe was helping me experience all of those things, which I was going to have to help my own patients through.
Mm-hmm.
Weird. I, and going forward, there were other things. Mm-hmm. So I had to leave my daughter at the hospital one night. And then I was back. I think I was gone for about 12 hours because I didn't trust them. And I was back there in a flash.
Why did they make you leave?
You couldn't stay. I got you got two nights. That was it. You know, we don't need mothers here. We don't.
I
we
see. Don't need Even with the hemorrhaging.
Well, I wasn't going to take an. I wasn't going to be infused. I had to
right.
Go home.
Right. Oh my God.
So the resident told me that she needed to. She was there because of her bilirubin. And I was like, no, that's not why she's here. You'll have to give her to me because you clearly don't know what she's eating. So give her back. Mm-hmm. And I took her home and proceeded to try and nurse her. I'd already been teaching lactation, but doing it and teaching it very different. And the amount of information that we knew about lactation in the 70s was not good. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of anecdotal stuff, a lot of passed on information, a lot of stuff that wasn't real.
Right.
So I had a wonderful pediatrician and I would talk to the midwife every day, but I was in tears every time I nursed and she was biting, but she gained 4 pounds in a month. And the pediatrician was like, Robin, she's fine. I was like, you should be on this side. And he gave, right. You know, take some, there was no ibuprofen back then. So take some Tylenol, ice your nipples, grit your teeth, take a comb and put it in your hand. So the pain.
Oh, come on.
Well, it turned out that she had a clenched jaw and my senses with her, it was because I was pushing so long. She wasn't fully tongue-tied, but she had a very, very tight jaw. And now what I do is I refer to patients for craniosacral work to release the trigger points in the jaw so that babies have to gape when they nurse. Their mouth becomes a vacuum. Mm-hmm. Babies don't chew breast milk out. They vacuum it out of the breast. Mm-hmm. And if their jaw muscles and their cheek muscle, their jaw and their cheek muscles are not able to do that, then they bite and they don't get much. At right. each. So they nurse all the time. And that's what she did. She nursed all the time so that she didn't starve. But in the meantime, she didn't starve. She gained a lot of weight and everybody thought she was fine. Well, she was fine. But
you weren't.
I wasn't.
Okay, I have a quick question. What's or maybe you're getting to it, but what is the difference between what a midwife does and what a doctor does, an OB does? What, surgery?
Medical students go from medical school to a residency. And that first year is an intern year. And when they pick a residency, the residency in obstetrics spends very little time with natural birth, with normal birth. They're really meant to learn surgery and to take care of complications of birth. So obstetricians take care of medical complications as well as obstetric complications. They went to medical school, understand about cardiac disease. They understand about renal disease, you know, kidney disease. They understand about autoimmune diseases. Although, for the most part, most general obstetricians will pass those things on to a maternal fetal medicine doc. So now the waters are getting kind of muddied in terms of whose territory is what.
Yeah.
Before I left White Plains Hospital, I was co-managing some very high-risk patients. What everybody needs to understand is there's always some piece of everyone's birth and pregnancy that a midwife takes care of, can take care of. There's always a piece of it, no matter how complicated it is. And that actually is the basis. It's that relationship of empathy. And I think empathy is probably the most important piece of it. Understanding how to translate and normalize even the most abnormal situation. And to find a way to advocate for that woman in that space, and that family also. It's not just women, but families. Mm-hmm. And I remember when Northwell first bought us, one of the docs, I had an interview with him because I said, you know, we need, midwives are independent and we need to be a seat at the table in all of these conversations that are going on. And he said, well, can I just ask you a couple of questions? And I was like, yeah, sure. And he's like, so if you, do you ever use Pitocin? Mm-hmm. So, and I was like, of course. But you don't use fetal monitors. So how do you use Pitocin? And I was like, what? I said, of course we use fetal monitors. In fact, we use them when they're appropriate. We don't use fetal monitors on everyone because it's been shown that fetal monitoring essentially isn't a well-documented science yet, but we use it when it's appropriate because we have a complication or we have meconium or we have Pitocin or we use it. His lack of knowledge about what midwives were, who they were, what they did, was actually kind of scary with the thought that they were buying us at that point.
Right. Well, what year was that?
That was only 2 years ago.
Oh my gosh. Oh wait. Okay. So I have to ask what fetal monitoring is because I just assumed it meant heart rate, but is it other stuff too?
No, fetal monitoring is a biomedical engineering tool that listens to the baby's heartbeat and picks up contractions.
Okay.
And in a lot of places now, women go in the hospital in labor, they get hooked up to these belts and they stay on them from the time they walk in till the time they have a baby.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in some ways it's incredibly restrictive. Although at Phelps, we bought into a system that had telemetry. So there were no wires. So women could.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
Could go in the bathtub with it.
Wow.
But there are other hospitals in the area who will go unnamed who, you know, you walk in, you go on a monitor, you never move out of your bed.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a horrible thing to do to women in labor. And so the necessity of using epidurals goes up dramatically because I can tell you the worst place to have a contraction is in bed.
Mm.
It's like driving nails, right? It's horrible. Horrible.
Is there a favorite position or is it different for everybody?
It's kind of different. It depends on where the baby is. Depends on how the baby's coming through. Depends on the woman's musculature. And so what I tell women is that labor is an architectural experiment. Mm. And the experiment occurs between the muscles and bones of the baby's head with the muscles and bones of the woman's pelvis.
Mm-hmm.
And how babies come through has a lot to do. There are just so many variables that we know nothing about.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had one of the docs I worked with once was an engineer. He had gone through school before medical school. He'd gotten an engineering degree. And he said to me, this whole thing is really crazy. There should be a way to decide ahead of time whether this will work or it won't work. And I said to him, and he actually really did truly believe that. And he practiced that way, that there's a way to decide ahead of time whether this thing was going to work or not. And I was like,
no,
don't work like that.
I wish there was too, buddy.
I did say that to him. I said, you know, we could save a lot of grief for some people, but there are women that I've known that the likelihood was very small that they were going to deliver vaginally, but who just need to experience to a point. You don't want to push it too far, but there is a part of women experiencing contractions and experiencing that.
You know what I'm realizing while we're talking is that like there's like a fine line for me between hearing stuff about pregnancy and birth in the state of mind that I'm in right now, where before I would be clamoring for answers to all of these questions, but part of me is like, I don't want to ask. No, nope, I don't want to get into it, but I want to, because my listeners want to, and I want you to talk about all of your stuff.
But Molly, also the piece that you went through is a piece that's very profound, but there should have been a way to help you avoid the grief, not the grief, but the extent to which your pregnancy continued. I wish that I had had a chance to get a really good look at your records in California, because there is no way that you should have been this far along when we found out.
Really? You don't think so?
I don't. I would ask Dr. Lascaux, but I don't.
I mean, he was surprised that this wasn't picked up on my 20 week. It was about 19 and a half weeks, but.
So some brain issues show up as early as 12 or 13 weeks. Sometimes it's difficult to absolutely make the diagnosis for a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
But I try very hard never to do this, to second guess a practitioner before me, because I don't know what their expertise was or what was going on at the time. But I remember saying that how the hell did this happen? I wonder why it hadn't been picked up before.
Well, I've spoken to other women who've terminated for medical issues, medical reasons, some who've had brain abnormalities, and a lot of them have told me that a lot of brain abnormalities don't show up until later on in pregnancies.
Some things don't show up until later on in pregnancies.
But mine should, the one that I had?
I'm pretty sure yours, if they were looking carefully, yours would have been there.
Wow. I mean, I remember the scan very well, and she was very focused the whole time. And the only thing that was non-average was the baby's belly looked big. That was it. Yeah. And she just said it wasn't outside of the, you know, it wasn't.
A lot, you know, when it comes to ultrasound, it's a tool. And, you know, there are people who are good at certain tools and people that are not as good with certain tools. And I know, in fact, that's one of the reasons that we are so careful about, you know, women will say, well, you know what, I really want to have my ultrasound at this lab because it's so much closer to my house.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I think it got to a point where everybody understood that my answer was going to be no.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as we were going through different staff, every once in a while, somebody would say, oh, yeah, go ahead. And then I would get this ultrasound back from somebody I didn't know. And I'd be like, this means nothing to me.
Right. Yeah.
This means absolutely nothing to me. Yes. Yeah. Okay. There's a heart, there's a brain, there's, you know, this means nothing to me.
Yeah.
And that's how much I trusted the maternal, the second guy that you
went to. Yes.
That's how much we trusted his ultrasounds.
Great. Great.
Because I knew that he was looking at it with an eye of somebody who was an expert at fetal anatomy.
For me, when this happened, I was shocked. And it felt like everybody around me was shocked too, that this doesn't happen all the time.
Doesn't.
But it has to happen a little bit more than, I mean, it can't be that rare.
Yes, it can.
Well, how often do you see things like this happen?
So our practice is not, it's not huge. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But even when I was with the docs in my previous practice,
mm-hmm.
a pregnancy that got to 20 weeks. So when nuchal translucencies became, mm-hmm. that helped. And so there were women who were starting to have to intervene earlier for testing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it got better. We were able to find abnormal pregnancies that women and families were not willing to continue, affected pregnancies that families were comfortable terminating earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a D&C. It was sad. And I'm not saying it wasn't sad, but it was a D&C and it didn't have the same pathos
mm-hmm.
in some ways. I would say women who actually got to 20 weeks with an abnormal pregnancy or an affected pregnancy that they chose to terminate either was because they were very late to prenatal care or the actual diagnosis took a few more weeks to develop.
Mm-hmm.
There was a sense that there was something wrong, but not enough information for patients to clearly make a decision to continue or not to continue, or that it took them time to come to terms with whether they were going to continue or not. But to get to 24 or 25 weeks, I hadn't had to look for a practitioner. The guy that I used had already retired.
The guy that you used to use?
Yeah.
Refer to?
Mm-hmm. He'd retired. Now,
yeah, because it was surprising to me that you guys didn't have somebody that you knew right off the bat. And I guess that's because
it's just not that doesn't happen that often. Now, for for women who are late to pregnancy, that's a different, and I didn't see that many women who were that late to pregnancy.
Late in age?
No, late to pregnancy diagnosis.
Oh, sure.
When I was in the big practice, we would sometimes see somebody who didn't show up until, 16 weeks. Right. And then that was the first time we did any testing and found anything. And once we were offering prenatal genetic testing routinely, the most common genetic abnormalities were those in women under the age of 35, because everybody else was being tested. Women over the age of 35 were all being tested. Mm-hmm. And then nuchal translucency came in, and we were doing much fewer amniocentesis. Mm-hmm. And this may come out wrong, but affected pregnancies became somewhat romanticized in that we can do this. We wouldn't make a decision to terminate a pregnancy just because the baby had a chromosomal abnormality, unless it was devastating and they were going to die at a later date.
I'm not sure what you're saying. What became romanticized? Or
The idea of carrying a pregnancy, it became harder for couples to decide to terminate a pregnancy where there was an affected child, mostly Down syndrome, and some other.
Why? Are you saying because of like a trend in society, you mean?
I think so.
Oh.
There was a program in the 90s, I think, with a boy who had Down syndrome, who was very high.
Corky? Yeah.
He was actually a patient of ours.
Stop it.
His mom was a very big mover and shaker in the community. And I think because we couldn't tell somebody how affected a pregnancy was going to be. Mm-hmm. So it was, everybody's fantasy was that's the high functioning child they were going to have.
I hear you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't include, that show doesn't talk about the heart defects that
babies. Or the pulmonary, or the life expectancy. Which
yeah.
Is better,
but yeah.
It was serious. It was serious. But anyway, so I think, we're seeing far fewer amniocentesis for, women.
Yeah, because of NT scans. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's, yes. Now stillbirths. The number is like 1 in 100 these days, isn't it? According to, the CDC or something.
I don't know that I can quote you. I'm really bad at statistics.
It's okay. I'm just shocked that it's anywhere near that. Okay, according to the CDC, a stillbirth is the death or loss of a baby before or during delivery. Both miscarriage and stillbirth describe pregnancy loss, but they differ according to when the loss occurs. In the United States, a miscarriage is usually defined as loss of a baby before the 20th week of pregnancy, and a stillbirth is loss of a baby at or after 20 weeks of pregnancy. Stillbirth affects about 1 in 160 births, and each year about 24,000 babies are stillborn in the United States.
Stillbirths, either children who die in utero or mm-hmm. women who come in with already knowing that the fetal heart is gone. Mm-hmm. Those are tough too.
But you see them.
We see them.
Because in my mind, before any of this happened, I would have thought, it doesn't happen very often. I don't know why the number didn't really ever sink in, but now I feel like,
it's not that
uncommon.
Well, it's pretty uncommon.
I'm not trying to scare people.
I was gonna say, don't scare people. Because I will tell you, that's becoming the anxiety about women in pregnancy is so horrific. I felt like all I did for the last 10 years was calm women down that pregnancy is essentially a normal thing, and that yes, bad things happen, but most of the time bad things don't. And the reason that the bad things stick out is because they're so uncommon. Mm. And yet it seems to be that obstetrics is trying to make a name for itself by making all women high risk. And they're not. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, you create an anxiety level in women that's wrong. And, just little things. Like I would hear the ultrasonographer say, this is a big baby. Really? You have no idea. ultrasound in the third trimester is statistically so often off. Don't even open your mouth. Don't even open your mouth, because then the mother starts to say to herself, oh, this is a big baby. I'm probably not going to be able to deliver it vaginally. Mm-hmm. Most women can't figure out how a baby gets out of them. And even if it were the size of a kangaroo, Joey, they mm-hmm. couldn't figure out how it was going to slip out of them. You talk about a big baby like this, mm-hmm. you know, or about the baby's growth, or we need to induce you because the baby's, you know, big or small. Or I mean, it's just the number of women who are talked into inductions for all sorts of reasons are pretty high.
Okay, now speaking of fear, I never had any fear about childbirth before. Now I'm afraid of dying because of my blood loss. And my doctor who took care of me in the hospital said that she wouldn't discourage me from trying to get pregnant again, as long as I'm doing it at a hospital so that they have blood on hand in case it does happen again, but that I'm at a slightly higher risk of hemorrhaging, but not at a high risk in the general population.
Molly, your risk was compounded A, because of your age, but B, because of the way that you had to terminate the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. So we know that the risk of hemorrhage is higher in that situation, but I hemorrhaged the first time.
Right.
I told you I hemorrhaged. The second time I had the twins, I labored all day, got to 8 centimeters, got stuck at 8 centimeters for hours or something, end up with a cesarean section and hemorrhaged even worse.
Oh God, no.
Wait, so listen.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So listen, but what I tell people all the time is, in the old days, hemorrhage is what killed women, okay? Because we didn't have a blood bank. We had something that looked like Pitocin. We had ergot, which was a drug, but it wasn't easily available to home births. It helped, but a blood bank is what's changed the numbers. And now that we're seeing more women being induced, the numbers are going back up again. So that's why we try to explain to people it's a double-edged sword. So how do you handle, you know, a hemorrhage so that women are safer? So I will tell you that hemorrhage precautions are much, much better than they've ever been ever. And the drugs that we have to control them, you know, when I first started, we had some drugs, but that if those didn't work and packing the uterus didn't work, you ended up with hysterectomy. Right. We've seen so many advances between embolization of the umbilical or of the uterine artery. We've seen different ways of packing. We've seen better drugs that also have pros and cons, but better drugs in terms of stopping hemorrhage. Mm-hmm. So when a hemorrhage is handled correctly, it can be life-threatening, but it shouldn't be a death sentence.
Right, right. Okay. And
you have a blood bank.
I know.
And everybody should give blood whenever they can. That's my.
I love giving blood.
Give blood. I used to give blood all the time.
I used to too.
Yeah.
So women do have hemorrhaging in their first pregnant birth and go on to not have hemorrhaging in subsequent births, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If I have a patient who I know has had a hemorrhage in the first pregnancy, I try to look for what were the potential causes for it, and are they likely to repeat? There are women who have bleeding disorders, have clotting disorders. But there are also women who, you know, had a 4-day induction. They had a 10-pound baby. I mean, there's certain things that lend themselves to a hemorrhage. Then there are other women who we don't know. And so then we use something called active management of the third stage, which has us intervene with medication before the placenta even begins to release, so that the uterine muscle is what shears the placenta off. So the way that the placenta is discharged from the body is during labor, the uterus shrinks, the muscle cells, all the cells within the uterine muscle shrink down and collapse the overall size of the uterus. So imagine that it's a sweater that got somebody stuck in the dryer. Mm-hmm. It shrinks itself down, pushes the baby out, then continues to shrink. And as those cells contract and shrink away, they shear the placenta off and close. There are huge, what are called venules in those cells that are now closed off because the muscle is contracted around them.
Yeah.
It's when the uterine muscle doesn't contract around those wide open blood vessels that we have that kind of hemorrhage bleeding, or when there's something in the way that prevents the muscle from contracting down.
Like a clot
or pieces of placenta.
Uh-huh.
Or fibroid.
Ah, yes.
You know, fibroids can do it. Abnormal uterine muscle. So what we try and do is make sure that we get the uterus contracting, get the muscle layers working so that they effectively shear the placenta off and then contract down around it.
So you want to know what's crazy?
There's a lot of things that are crazy.
Yeah. But the day before my D&E, I went and talked to the doctor and I said, how do we make sure that my uterus clamps down? And I don't remember what his answer was, but I know I asked that question. And lo and behold, I thought that I was told at the time that it was a laceration in my cervix, but speaking with the doctor at the hospital a couple of weeks later, she told me that it was uterine atony.
Oh, it was. Because I had assumed that from when I talked to you that first night that there was the laceration.
Yeah.
Atony would have been
a laceration, but they stitched that and they said they think it was the atony and not.
Atony is a little bit more difficult to control than lacerations. You can just stitch it closed. That's why I was a little surprised, but it was more like it was atony. And atony would have been a more common reason. That's why I hemorrhaged the first time. It was atony. Okay. And that's why I hemorrhaged the second time. It was atony.
Mm.
But you live. I lived after it. You know, I do say to myself that, but for modern medicine, I would have survived the first one, but I would have been one of those women whose headstones was my second birth, you know?
So
that one probably I wouldn't have recovered from.
Yeah. I asked the doctors too about me. I said, you know, if I hadn't gotten to the hospital, would I have died? And they said, yeah.
You threatened.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a scary thought. I've never had it before. And now I'm debating whether or not I want to try to get pregnant again with, I have frozen eggs.
Having spoken to you, you know, over these past months, my sense is you long to be a mom.
Yes.
And there are multiple ways to be a mom, to touch your maternal side and to offer that part of you to the world. I don't think it has to be biological. I've taken care of so many women who, for whatever reason, have been unable to conceive or who've been unable to carry a pregnancy. I come from the days before our fertility work was really, really not great. And from the early days of IVF, of women who tried and tried and tried, and having watched that angst and having listened to those women who society's belief that, you know, a woman isn't truly a woman unless she's born children, it should give us pause in that we should understand that there are other ways to show our maternal side, and it doesn't have to be biological. But I also don't see anything in your situation that would preclude you doing this again. Seriously, it really will come down to what you believe that you're, what you can tolerate.
No.
Well, I've been with women who've miscarried over and over and over, and they've said to me, should I try again? And I'm like, you have to decide what your what your heart can tolerate and how hurt you can be and mm-hmm. how resilient you feel you are. The body's incredibly resilient, but there's certain things that, you know, certain parts of the envelope we shouldn't push because the damage is psychologically, the damage is just too great. Mm-hmm. But so those are decisions that you have to make for yourself without, you'll know whether it's something you can do or whether it's something you can't do or whether there's some other way you need to go on this.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I'm definitely exploring all of my options right now. There's just so many. It's not easy to adopt and it's not easy to foster. And
depending on what you want to foster, it's relatively easy to.
Well,
foster.
It's emotionally, it's not easy for me because different. Of the loss.
Right.
I can't imagine having to give up a kid that I was, you know, had fallen in love with. Yeah. And then adoption is incredibly expensive. And yeah, for me, IVF has always seemed easier than doing those things. I know that sounds a little weird.
What if you were to, surrogacy is very expensive in some states it's illegal, but it's illegal in New York State. But could you imagine letting someone else carry the pregnancy?
It could happen. The reason I've always wanted to be pregnant and give birth and breastfeed.
You could breastfeed.
Birth. Right. I don't know if it's that important for me to have my biological material out there to go to that length of getting a surrogate.
Right. Okay.
When one of the driving forces of me going through all of this to begin with was being pregnant, wanting to share that experience with my mom and the rest of women of throughout time and childbirth and breastfeeding. Yeah. And I know that I could potentially breastfeed if I adopted. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that until
I've had a lot of patients done it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's just a lot of options. That's all.
The problem is at your age, adoption gets much more difficult and it is. Mm. You know what? I refer to women of a certain age and it's an incredibly expensive. Mm-hmm. If you're willing to adopt an affected child, it gets easier, but as a single parent, I know this is going to sound horrible, but I've been a single parent for a short period of my life, but I can't imagine going through a pregnancy and a birth and those early months or years after as a single parent, unless I had a lot of support. It puts women at risk. I think it puts children at risk because it's incredibly emotionally strenuous and draining. Children are very cute, but they take a lot of energy and it's hard. It's very hard.
Yeah. I mean, but that's why I moved back east to be with my mom who's had a boatload of children. Okay. Gosh, how many births do you think you've done?
So a lot of midwives keep a logbook, and I did for the first 15 years. I kept a logbook.
Yeah.
I think it's over 2,000. Probably.
Oh my God.
Closer to 2,500, I think, over the years.
Wow. So. Wow. Do any of them stand out as
absolutely
the most incredible or the worst? Don't tell me about the worst.
Well, worst for me. I mean, there are some that were just emotionally difficult for me. The first one I did was just such a high. And it was such an easy birth. I mean, it was her second kid. And baby, I mean, a taxi driver could have delivered this baby. But for me, it was like, this is great. I remember the first set of twins I delivered. I remember the biggest baby I ever delivered.
How big?
12, 13 and a half.
Wow.
it was her third baby. And uh-huh. all of her kids had been in the 9.5 to 10 pound range. Mm-hmm. Well, the first one was 9.5. I think the second one was 10.4. And she delivered really fast. Oh. She would come in just about fully dilated and would deliver a half an hour later. So this third time she says to me, Robin, I've never actually been able to experience the birth. Can I have an epidural this time?
Wait, I don't understand.
With her third baby. She said to me, can I?
She wanted the epidural so that it would take longer?
Yeah, so that she could actually see the baby coming out.
Oh my God.
So I said, well, okay, you have to show up sooner this time than you usually.
Yeah.
Because there won't be enough time. So sure enough, she comes in. I mean, she was 8 centimeters or something when she showed up. But labor and delivery was crazy. So I was actually in an OR delivering a baby on this little sky table. And she got her epidural on the OR table, sat up, threw up on my feet, and proceeded to push this baby out with the biggest head I had seen in a very long time. And I was all by myself. The nurses were everywhere else.
Oh my God.
It was her and her husband and me. And I see this baby and quietly I say to myself, holy shit. But I rotated the head, the shoulders, the baby fell out again. But when I lifted it up, it was like, oh.
Oh my God.
The neonatologist came over and was yelling at me, how could I possibly have let her deliver vaginally when it's such a big baby? And I was like, all right, you tell me if you can tell the difference between a 10 and a half pound baby and a 12 pound baby.
Yeah.
Anyway, but when we found out how much it weighed, I just freaked.
That's crazy. What do you do when a baby is stuck in the birth canal? And then, or what do you do if somebody's been pushing for many, many hours, days, whatever, and it's just not happening? And then they go for a C-section. Isn't the baby's head kind of stuck in the pelvic area?
Well, no.
What if you can see the baby's head outside of the vulva?
So you're describing two different things. So one of the things that can happen is that the baby's head starts to evolve and we have something called a shoulder dystocia.
Uh-huh.
That's when the after coming shoulder mm-hmm. is impacted under the symphysis or somewhere in the bony pelvis.
Okay.
That was, I think, one of my worst deliveries. We've all had any midwife or physician worth their salt will tell you they've had shoulder dystocia and of varying degrees. Some are easy, some are a little tight and you rotate them around and they just come out. But I had one that was significant and she went very quickly. She pushed the baby out in like 20 minutes, but the head came out and then the shoulders refused.
Okay. I think my brother had that. Well, they threatened to break his clavicle.
So I ended up having to break the clavicle. And the baby's arms were actually crisscrossed over its body. So each time I turned, the arms would cross the other way. Typically what you try to do is bring the arm out, but I couldn't because they kept flipping. Anyway.
Yeah.
And the baby had what's called an Erb's palsy, where there was a stretching of the nerve arm. But otherwise, the baby came out fine. It was no other ill effects. So, but back in the day, there were worse situations that happened. In the case where somebody's in labor and they've been pushing and pushing and pushing and the baby's head's not coming down, or the baby's head comes down to a certain place but won't go any further, you can actually push the baby's head back up into the pelvis so that you can do a cesarean section and get the head out.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
I mean, honestly, sometimes when you do a cesarean section, there's somebody underneath the table pushing the head up and you can actually see their fingers.
Oh, wow.
You take the baby's head out.
Wow.
Yeah, freaky.
Okay. What about breech births? Does that happen? Do you deliver them vaginally ever?
I haven't done a breech birth for probably about 20 years. Then the last one I did was an accident.
So do they insist on C-sections or do they try and turn?
No, we try and turn almost all of, we offer to try and turn all of our breeches. We have a couple of docs at Phelps that are phenomenal at turning breeches. We used to do it in the office back when I was in the docs practice. We did it in the office. We didn't use medication. And every time the baby felt like it was breech, we would to get, you know, bring the head back down. We did some acupuncture, a lot of acupuncture, did a lot of Webster technique to help try and change the, sometimes the configuration of the pelvic bones didn't allow the head to settle in. So that, because the tush was, the breech was smaller, it fit easier in the pelvis. And if you open the pelvic bones and muscles to a bowl, the way they're supposed to be, the baby has room to move its head down.
Mm.
But there is always the risk of baby, the after coming head getting caught.
Oh, there is? Oh, God. Sorry, I yelled.
Oh, right. So what happens
I just didn't think of that. Okay.
What happens is the, depending on how the breech comes down, whether the legs are up in front of the face or the baby's sitting cross-legged,
right,
will determine how wide the pelvis, how wide the baby's pelvis is coming in. And so in some cases, it's the same diameter as the head, but in other cases, it's smaller.
Mm.
And so the baby's legs and body come through, and sometimes with, if you're not careful about the after coming head, and it flips up, the diameter around the head that's trying to come through the pelvis is huge, as opposed to tucking the chin this way.
And you do that manually?
You can tuck the chin manually. But we try to, you know, you try to get babies to do that themselves by just letting the weight of the baby's body make the head pull down like that, so that the head comes out. But sometimes the head is just significantly bigger and it won't come. And so that's every practitioner's
nightmare.
Nightmare. And the numbers of badly managed breaches increases the statistics, and the fact that residents just aren't being taught how to deliver a breech, except through an abdominal incision, which has its own issues also. I need you to hear. People need to know how to do that also. But they're just not trained the way they were. There's a group across the United States of practitioners who have come together to talk about training residents to deliver breeches again. It's only about 3% of total births, but again, if it's your first baby and there are people out there not being willing to do a vaginal birth after a previous section, it just increases the numbers of cesarean sections.
Yeah. Have you ever delivered a baby whose water hasn't broken so that they're still in the sac? That's cool.
As long as the baby's fine, it's good. I had one kid who was just, it was so much meconium. It was really kind of.
So I've seen just a bunch of videos online of the baby coming out and the sac hasn't broken. If that was happening, would you break it or you would leave it intact?
It depends on what's going on. If I really need to see whether there's any meconium, if I really think that there may have been a problem, I want to see that so I can get somebody in. And it makes it easier to get to the baby's mouth and nose. Right. But if things are going well and everybody's okay, it's fascinating to watch being born and what's, it's called being delivered in call, C-A-U.
Oh, okay. Oh gosh. Okay. Well, anyway, there's so much. Is there anything else you want to share about your story? Are you excited to retire?
I'm excited to retire. There were reasons that I needed to retire.
Right.
I get to spend more time with my husband. He came close to dying last year. And So he is well, and we kind of looked at this as a gift. You know, very few people survive a widowmaker heart attack.
And
so even fewer survive it twice. So we kind of figured the universe was trying to tell us something.
Yeah.
And we've both been, you know, he's a cop, and we've both been at somebody else's beck and call our entire careers. And although I've loved being at women's beck and call, my family and my husband have in some places, in some times in my life had to take second fiddle.
Mm.
I figured it was time to put him first. Although he didn't retire the way he was supposed to. He was supposed to retire this month with me and had to stall it a little bit. But anyway, But I don't know that I'm done. I don't know that I'm finished. But I'm retired from that, from what I was doing. I'm retired. Yeah. So whatever I do next will be different.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it is. It is exciting. It's exciting to wake up whenever I feel like it. It's exciting to stay up at night because I feel like staying up, not because I'm watching somebody in labor or waiting for a phone call.
Yeah.
And the snowstorm last week, to not have to worry about what I was going to do about rescheduling patients.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how relaxing that was.
Yeah. Well, and like I said the other day, I'm so grateful that I got to meet you in the couple of months that I was here and we crossed paths. And I'm so grateful for all the help you gave me during that period of time. It was a nightmare and you kept checking on me and you didn't have to do that. I mean, unless that is that your job?
That's okay.
I wasn't paying you to call me and check up on me. I don't think
your job. That's the difference, I think. But that should be our job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It meant a lot to me. It really did. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you for sharing that it did mean a lot to you.
Oh yes.
Well, I'm glad that you're finding your way through it. And I do wish you the best in terms of whatever you choose to do.
Thank you.
You'll be fine. Whatever you decide.
I think I like New York, though.
Do you?
So I think I'll be hanging here for a while.
California's crazy.
No, yeah. I love LA, but it's really nice to be.
LA is really crazy. you could be just as frenetic in New York City as you
are. I like the snow. I like my parents. I'm enjoying it so far. Yeah. So I think I'll be around here. So if I do get pregnant again, I'll hit you guys up.
Hit my partners up. But let
hit
me
your
know.
Partners up.
Really. Do let
I
me
will know. Let you know.
You have my number.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much, Robin.
Be well and take care.
Thank you. I'll talk to you soon.
Yep. Bye.
Bye. Well, Robin Bradley, I thank you so much. I mean, I know I just said that 1,000 times, but I mean it. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And I wish you the most wonderful, peaceful retirement, whether you're actively working as a midwife or not. I'm sure you'll continue to find a way to help women and babies. I just hope your husband holds up his end of the bargain and retires too. Hey, folks, I'm sorry that I'm always talking about scary things. I don't know if it's good or bad for you, but you know if it's good or bad for you, so you have a choice. If you don't want to hear, then it's okay. You don't have to listen. I don't know. I think there's a trade-off. I definitely don't want to give anyone anxiety about pregnancy and birth, but I do think it's good to be aware and prepared for any scenario, and I think knowledge can empower you or help you through a horrific situation, or it can help you to help a friend who may be experiencing something. But it is at the expense of, you know, blissful naivete, which sounds really, really, really great. But then, yeah, there's the whole blindsided thing. I don't know what's best, but I clearly tend to go down the path of information. I do know this. Now that I'm done editing, I'm going to watch The Bachelor. And there might be chicken inside for me, my new favorite food. Have I lost my mind? I'm just like having a conversation with a microphone right now. Who am I anymore? I don't know. I'm going to hit the road. Peace out. Join the Patreon if you can. Patreon.com/spermcast. I hope to get some adoption guests on the show next week. I did have some trouble finding an adoptee that wanted to talk to me, but I'll work even harder this week. And I did reach out to some adoption agencies and haven't heard back yet. Oh my goodness. I will. I'll figure it out. I've also emailed Dr. Chung. What else can I tell you? I'll give you more information on the genetic testing next week. It's all going to be great. Okay. Yeah. Patreon.com/spermcast. Venmo, Molly-Hawkey. Email me at spermcast@gmail.com. Leave me a voicemail at 323-741-1818. Find me on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter at spermcast. And if you're interested in fertility consultations, I'm here for you and happy to talk and listen. Mostly listen. Talk just a little bit. I hope you have a wonderful week. I hope I have a wonderful week. Fingers crossed. Talk to you soon. Mwah.
He could be bald and bearded, short or tall, funny, smart, love basketball, from gay, straight, black, white, tiny eyes with an underbite. I just need SpermCast.
An Erios production.
powered by Acast.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.